sat silent, frozen with defeat. He opened his wide black case and took out a cigarette. He took a deep lungful of smoke and expelled it between his teeth with a faint hiss. What now? Back to the hotel and bed, avoiding the commiserating eyes of Matisse and Leiter and Vespa? Back to the telephone call to London, and then tomorrow the plane home, the taxi up to Regent's Park, the walk up the stairs and along the corridor, and M's cold face across the table, his forced sympathy, his better luck next time, and, of course, there couldn't be one. Not another chance like this. He looked round the table and up at the spectators. Few were looking at him. They were waiting, waiting to see if anyone would conceivably challenge this huge bank of 32 million francs, this wonderful run of banker's luck. Leiter had vanished, not wishing to look Bond in the eye after the knockout, he supposed. Yet Vespa looked curiously unmoved, but then Bond reflected she knew nothing of the game. Had no notion, probably, of the bitterness of his defeat. The huissier was coming towards Bond inside the rail. He placed a squat envelope beside Bond on the table. It was as thick as a dictionary. Bond's heart thumped. He took the heavy, anonymous envelope below the level of the table and slit it open with his thumbnail, noticing that the gum was still wet on the flap. Unbelieving, and yet knowing it was true, he felt the broad wads of notes. He slipped them into his pockets, retaining the half-sheet of notepaper which was pinned to the topmost of them. Marshal aid, 32 million francs, with the compliments of the USA. Bond swallowed. He looked over towards Vespa. Felix Leiter was again standing beside her. He grinned slightly, and Bond smiled back and raised his hand from the table in a small gesture of benediction. Then he set his mind to sweeping away all traces of the sense of complete defeat which had swamped him a few minutes before. This was a reprieve, but only a reprieve. There could be no more miracles. This time, he had to win. The croupier had completed his task of making a pile of the giant stake in the middle of the table. There lay £32,000. Perhaps, thought Bond, Le Chiffre needed just one more coup, a few million francs, to achieve his object. Then he would have made his 50 million francs and would leave the table. He showed no signs of moving, and Bond guessed with relief that somehow he must have overestimated Le Chiffre's resources. At last, Le Chiffre nodded. Un banco de 32 millions. The croupier's voice rang out. A silence built itself up round the table. It was then that Bond leant slightly forward. Sweevey, he said quietly. There was an excited buzz round the table. The word ran through the casino. People crowded in. 32 million. For most of them, it was more than they had earned all their lives. It was, literally, a small fortune. One of the casino directors consulted with the chef de partie. The chef de partie turned apologetically to Bond. Excusez-moi, monsieur. La mise? It was an indication that Bond really must show he had the money to cover the bet. They knew, of course, that he was a very wealthy man, but after all, 32 millions. It was when Bond shoveled the great wad of notes out onto the table that he caught a swift exchange of glances between Le Chiffre and the gunman standing directly behind Bond. Immediately, he felt something hard press into the base of his spine. At the same time, a thick voice speaking southern French said softly, urgently, just behind his right ear, "This is a gun, monsieur. It is absolutely silent. It can blow the base of your spine off without a sound. You will appear to have fainted. I shall be gone. Withdraw your bet before I count 10. If you call for help, I shall fire." The voice was confident. Bond believed it. The thick walking stick was explained. Bond knew the type of gun. He had tested them himself. Said the voice. Bond turned his head. There was the man, leaning forward close behind him, smiling broadly under his black moustache, as if he was wishing Bond luck, completely secure in the noise and the crowd. The discoloured teeth came together. D, said the grinning mouth. Bond looked across. Le Chiffre was watching him. His eyes glittered back at Bond. His mouth was open and he was breathing fast. Trois. Bond looked over at Vesper and Felix Leiter. They were smiling and talking to each other. The fools. Where was Matisse? Where were those famous men of his? Quatre. Couldn't someone see what was happening? Cinq. The croupier was tidying up the pile of notes. The chef de partie bowed smilingly towards Bond. Directly the stake was in order, he would announce, Le jeu est fait. And the gun would fire, whether the gunman had reached 10 or not.
Six.
Bond decided. It was a chance. He carefully moved his hands to the edge of the table, gripped it, edged his buttocks right back, feeling the sharp gun sight grind into his coccyx.
Sept.
The chef de partie turned to Le Chiffre with his eyebrows lifted, waiting for the banker's nod that he was ready to play. Suddenly, Bond heaved backwards with all his strength. His momentum tipped the crossbar of the chair back down so quickly that it cracked across the Malacca tube and wrenched it from the gunman's hand before he could pull the trigger. Bond went head over heels onto the ground amongst the spectators' feet, his legs in the air. There were cries of dismay. Hands helped him to his feet and brushed him down. Bond held on to the brass rail. He looked confused and embarrassed. He brushed his hands across his forehead.
A momentary faintness, he said. It is nothing. The excitement, the heat.
There were expressions of sympathy. Would monsieur prefer to withdraw, to lie down, to go home? Should a doctor be fetched? Bond shook his head. He was perfectly all right now. His excuses to the table. To the banker, also. A new chair was brought, and he sat down. He looked across at Le Chiffre. Through his relief at being alive, he felt a moment of triumph at what he saw. Some fear in the fat, pale face. There was no trace of the gunman, but the huissier was looking for someone to claim the Malacca stick. Bond beckoned to him.
If you will give it to that gentleman over there.
He indicated Felix Leiter. He will return it. It belongs to an acquaintance of his. Bond grimly reflected that a short examination would reveal to Leiter why he had made such an embarrassing public display of himself. He turned back to the table and tapped the green cloth in front of him to show that he was ready.
La partie continue, announced the chef impressively. Un banco de 32 millions.
The spectators craned forward. Bond's mind was clear again. By a miracle, he had survived a devastating wound. The success of his gambit with the chair had wiped out all memories of the dreadful valley of defeat through which he had just passed. The cards were waiting for him. They must not fail him. The two cards slithered towards him across the green sea. Like an octopus under a rock, Le Chiffre watched him from the other side of the table. Would it be the lift of the heart which a 9 brings or an 8 brings? He fanned the two cards under the curtain of his hand. The muscles of his jaw rippled as he clenched his teeth. His whole body stiffened in a reflex of self-defense. He had two queens, two red queens. They looked roguishly back at him from the shadows. They were the worst. They were nothing. Zero. Baccarat. A card, said Bond, fighting to keep hopelessness out of his voice. He felt Le Chiffre's eyes boring into his brain. The banker slowly turned his own two cards face up. He had a count of three, a king and a black three. Bond softly exhaled a cloud of tobacco smoke. He still had a chance. Now he was really faced with a moment of truth. Le Chiffre slapped the shoe, slipped out a card, Bond's fate, and slowly turned it face up. It was a 9. A wonderful 9 of hearts. The card known in gypsy magic as a whisper of love, a whisper of hate. The card that meant almost certain victory for Bond. Bond's cards lay on the table before him. The two impersonal, pale pink patterned backs and the faced
nine of hearts. The sweat was running down either side of the banker's beaky nose. His thick tongue came out slyly and licked a drop out of the corner of his red gash of a mouth. He looked at Bond's cards, and then at his own, and then back at Bond's. Then his whole body shrugged, and he slipped out a card for himself from the lisping shoe. He faced it. The table craned. It was a wonderful card. A five.
Huit à la banque, said the croupier.
As Bond sat silent, Le Chiffre suddenly grinned wolfishly. He must have won. The croupier's spatula reached almost apologetically across the table. There was not a man at the table who did not believe Bond was defeated. The spatula flicked the two pink cards over on their backs. The gay red queens smiled up at the lights.
Villeneuve!
A great gasp went up round the table, and then a hubbub of talk. Bond's eyes were on Le Chiffre. The big man fell back in his chair as if slugged above the heart. His mouth opened and shut once or twice in protest, and his right hand felt at his throat. As the huge stack of plaque was shunted across the table to Bond, the banker reached into an inner pocket of his jacket and threw a wad of notes onto the table. The croupier riffled through them.
Un banco de 10 millions, he announced.
This is the kill, thought Bond. This man has reached the point of no return. He has come to where I stood an hour ago, and he is making the last gesture that I made. But if this man loses, there is no one to come to his aid. No miracle to help him. Bond sat back and lit a cigarette. On a small table beside him, half a bottle of Clicquot and a glass had materialized. Without asking who the benefactor was, Bond filled the glass to the brim and drank it down in two long draughts.
Banco, he said, speaking straight at Le Chiffre.
Once more the two cards were borne over to him, and this time the croupier slipped them into the green lagoon between his outstretched arms. Bond curled his right hand in, glanced briefly down, and flipped the cards face up into the middle of the table.
Le Neuf, said the croupier.
Le Chiffre was gazing down at his own two black kings.
Le Baccarat.
And the croupier eased across the table the fat tide of plaque. Le Chiffre watched them go to join the serried millions in the shadow of Bond's left arm. Then he stood up slowly, and without a word he brushed past the players to the break in the rail. He unhooked the velvet-covered chain and let it fall. The spectators opened a way for him. They looked at him curiously and rather fearfully, as if he carried the smell of death on him. Then he vanished from Bond's sight. At the hotel, Leiter insisted on accompanying Bond to his room. Both men had their hands on their guns. It was as Bond had left it 6 hours before.
No reception committee, observed Leiter. But I wouldn't put it past them to try a last throw. Do you think I ought to stay up and keep you company?
Oh, you get your sleep, said Bond. They won't be interested in me without the money, and I've got an idea for looking after that. Thanks for all you've done. I hope we get on a job again one day.
Suits me, said Leiter. So long as you can draw a 9 when it's needed.
And bring Vesper along with you,
he added dryly. He went out and closed the door. Bond turned away and took out of his pocket the check for 40 million francs. He folded this very small. Then he opened the door and looked up and down the corridor. He left the door wide open, and with his ears cocked for footsteps or the sound of the lift, he set to work with a small screwdriver. 5 minutes later, he gave a last-minute survey to his handiwork, put some fresh cigarettes in his case, closed and locked the door, and went off down the corridor and across the hall and out into the moonlight. Bond took Vesper's arm and led her over the gilded step of the Roi Galant. The nightclub was small and dark, lit only by candles in gilded candelabra. In the far corner, A trio consisting of a piano, an electric guitar and drums was playing La Vie en Rose with muted sweetness. Seduction dripped on the quietly throbbing air. They were given a corner table near the door. Bond ordered a bottle of Veuve Clicquot and scrambled eggs and bacon. They sat for a time listening to the music, and then Bond turned to Vesper.
It's wonderful sitting here with you and knowing the job's finished. It's a lovely end to the day. The prize giving.
He expected her to smile. She said, "Yes, isn't it?" in a rather brittle voice. Between the thumb and first two fingers of her right hand, she held one of Bond's cigarettes, as an artist holds a crayon, and though she smoked with composure, she tapped the cigarette occasionally into an ashtray, when the cigarette had no ash. Bond noticed these small things because he felt intensely aware of her, and wanted to draw her into his own feeling of relaxed sensuality. But he accepted her reserve. He thought it came from a desire to protect herself from him, or else was a reaction to his coolness earlier. He was patient. He drank champagne and talked a little about the happenings of the day. She answered perfunctorily. She sipped at her champagne and rarely glanced at Bond. He felt frustrated. The scrambled eggs came, and they ate in silence. At 4 o'clock, Bond was about to call for the bill, when the maître d'hôtel appeared at their table and inquired for Miss Lind. He handed her a note, which she took and read hastily.
"Oh, it's only Mathis," she said. "He says what I come to the entrance hall. He's got a message for you. Perhaps he's not in evening clothes or something. I won't be a minute. Then perhaps we could go home."
She gave him a strained smile.
"I'm afraid I don't feel very good company this evening. It's been a rather nerve-wracking day. I'm so sorry."
Bond watched her take the few steps to the entrance. He lit a cigarette. He felt flat. He took a last mouthful of champagne. It tasted bitter, as the first glass too many always does. He would have liked to have seen Matisse's cheerful face and heard his news, perhaps even a word of congratulation. Suddenly, the note to Vesper seemed odd to him. It was not the way Matisse would do things. He would have joined them in the nightclub, whatever his clothes. Bond hastily paid the bill, not waiting for the change. He hurried through the gaming room and looked carefully up and down the long entrance hall. He cursed and quickened his step. No Vesper, no Matisse. He was almost running. He got to the entrance and was halfway down the steps when he heard a faint cry, then the slam of a door way to the right. With a harsh growl and stutter from the exhaust, a beetle-browed Citroën shot out of the shadows into the light of the moon. Its tail rocked on its soft springs as if a violent struggle was taking place on the back seat. With a snarl, it raced out to the wide entrance gate in a spray of gravel. A small black object shot out of an open rear window and thudded into a flower bed. The car haired off between the shops on the main street towards the coast road. Bond knew he would find Vesper's evening bag among the flowers. He ran back with it across the gravel to the brightly lit steps and scrabbled through its contents. The crumpled note was there amongst the usual feminine baggage. "Can you come to the entrance hall for a moment? I have news for your companion, René Matisse." It was the crudest possible forgery. Bond leapt for the Bentley, blessing the impulse which had made him drive it over after dinner. As the car rocked to the left outside the gate, Bond settled himself for the pursuit, briefly savouring the echo of the huge exhaust. Soon he was out on the coast road, a broad highway through the sand dunes, which he knew from his morning's drive. He knew the Citroën must have come this way. He hoped soon to see the distant shaft of its headlights. The night was still and clear. As he drove, whipping the car faster and faster through the night, with the other half of his mind he cursed Vesper and M for having sent her on the job. This was just what he had been afraid of, these blithering women who thought they could do a man's work. Why the hell couldn't they stay at home and mind their pots and pans and stick to their frocks and gossip? For Vesper to fall for an old trick like that and get herself snatched and probably held to ransom like some bloody heroine in a strip cartoon. Bond boiled at the thought of the fix he was in. Of course. The idea was a straight swap. The girl against his cheque for 40 million. Well, he wouldn't play. Wouldn't think of playing. She was in the service and knew what she was up against. He wouldn't even ask M. The job was more important than her. Bond's mind raged furiously on with the problem as he flung the great car down the coast road, automatically taking the curves. He knew he must be gaining fast. On an impulse, he slowed down to 70 and turned on his fog lights. Sure enough, without the blinding curtain of his own headlights, he could see the glow of another car a mile or two down the coast. Ahead, in the Citroën, there were three men and the girl. Le Chiffre was driving, his big fluid body hunched forward, his hands light and delicate on the wheel. Beside sat the squat man who had carried the stick in the casino. In his left hand he grasped a thick lever. In the back seat was the tall, thin gunman. His right hand lay caressingly on Vespa's left thigh, which stretched out naked beside him. Apart from her legs, which were naked to the hips, Vespa was only a parcel. Her long black velvet skirt had been lifted over her arms and head and tied above her head with a piece of rope. Where her face was, a small gap had been torn in the velvet so that she could breathe. She was not bound in any other way, and she lay quiet, her body moving sluggishly with the swaying of the car. Le Chiffre was concentrating half on the road ahead and half on the onrushing glare of Bond's headlights in the driving mirror. He seemed undisturbed when not more than a mile separated the hare from the hounds, and he even brought the car down from 80 to 60 miles an hour. Now, as he swept round a bend, he slowed down still further. In the mirror, Bond's great headlights were lighting up the bend. Le Chiffre seemed to make up his mind.
Allez.
The man beside him pulled the lever sharply upwards. The boot at the back of the car yawned open like a whale's mouth. There was a tinkling clatter on the road. Le Chiffre threw the Citroën left-handed down a narrow side road. He stopped the car with a jerk, and all three men got swiftly out and doubled back under cover of a low hedge to the crossroads, now fiercely illuminated by the lights of the Bentley. Each of them carried a revolver. The Bentley screamed down towards them like an express train. As Bond hurtled round the bend, he was working out his plan of action. He imagined that the enemy driver would try to dodge off into a side road if he got the chance, so when he saw no lights ahead, it was a normal reflex to prepare to brake. He was only doing about 60 as he approached the black patch across the right-hand crown of the road, which he assumed to be the shadow cast by a wayside tree. Even so, there was no time to save himself. There was suddenly a small carpet of glinting steel spikes right under his offside wing. Then he was on top of it. The heavy car whirled across the road in a tearing dry skid, slammed the left bank with a crash that knocked Bond out of the driving seat onto the floor, and then, facing back up the road, it reared slowly up, its front wheels spinning and its great headlights searching the sky. For a split second, resting on the petrol tank, it seemed to pour at the heavens like a giant praying mantis. Then slowly it toppled over backwards and fell with a splintering crash of coachwork. Le Chiffre and his two men only had to walk a few yards from their ambush.
"Put your guns away and get him out," he ordered brusquely. "Be careful of him. I don't want a corpse."
The two men got down on their knees. One of them took out a long knife and cut some of the fabric away from the side of the convertible hood and took hold of Bond's shoulders. He was unconscious and immovable. The thin man felt his heart and then slapped his face hard on either side. Bond grunted and moved a hand. The thin man slapped him again.
"That's enough," said Le Chiffre. "Tie his arms and put him in the car. Here."
He threw a roll of flex to the man. He walked back to the car. His face showed neither pleasure nor excitement. It was the sharp bite of the wire flex into his wrists that brought Bond to himself. When he was yanked to his feet and pushed towards the narrow side road where the engine of the Citroën was already running softly, he found that no bones were broken. But he felt in no mood for desperate attempts to escape and allowed himself to be dragged into the back seat of the car without resisting. He looked to the right, past the thin man who was lying back with his eyes closed. His first reaction was one of scorn. Damn fool girl getting herself trussed up like a chicken. But then he felt sorry for her. Her naked legs looked so childlike and defenseless.
"Vesper,"
he said softly. There was no answer from the bundle in the corner, and Bond suddenly had a chill feeling. But then she stirred slightly. At the same time, the thin man caught him a hard, backhanded blow over the heart.
"Silence."
Bond doubled over with the pain. The thin man had hit him a hard, professional-cutting blow with the edge of the hand. There was something rather deadly about his accuracy and lack of effort. Le Chiffre reversed furiously back onto the main road. By now it was dawn, about 5 o'clock, Bond guessed, and he reflected that a mile or two on was the turning to Le Chiffre's villa. Now that he realized that Vesper had only been a sprat to catch a mackerel, the whole picture became clear. It was an extremely unpleasant picture. For the first time since his capture, fear came to Bond and crawled up his spine. He knew that he was utterly and absolutely in their power.